طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we bring back to This Week in Palestine one of the most progressive and passionate Palestinian activists at work today in the U.S. and around the world, Ali Abu Nima, co-founder and driving force behind the Palestinian news service, the Electronic Intifada. He spoke at the New York Forum a few weeks ago for an hour and a half. Usually we would edit such a long presentation down to fit into the time frame for our program, but this is such a fabulous organic presentation that we decided to broadcast the entire recording over 2 weeks of This Week in Palestine. If you miss one of them, you can always go to our archive at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and find the missing piece. So here is week one of Ali Abu Nima speaking at the New York Forum on the deal of the century and the ongoing imperialist attacks on Palestine.
All right. Hello, everybody. Thank you all for joining us. My name is Leanne. I work at the People's Forum, which is a political education and cultural center for internationalist and working class movement building in New York City. We're all here virtually, as we've been for the past few months, as our physical space is still closed while we're seeing how the coronavirus outbreak develops. So thank you to all of you who've been joining us virtually on YouTube or on Zoom. Welcome from wherever you're logging in from. Here in New York or around the country or around the world. I'm thrilled to welcome today Ali Abu Nima, who's joining us to discuss the current developments in Palestine during this time of intensified global crisis. We've all seen and we've been discussing and experiencing how the imperialist states have been responding to this economic and health crisis in a moment when human life is even more vulnerable than before. They've been accelerating attacks on all of human life in all corners of the world, military, political, economic. And the prime example of this is, of course, the Israeli government has also intensified violence against the Palestinian people. And they've renewed efforts to continue their policy of land theft. There's been a proposal in the past, at the end of May, to annex 30% of the West Bank. And this annexation plan comes with full support from the United States, its main ally. So, I mean, we have a lot of questions as people who are against imperialism, against Zionism. We have many questions, and I'm really grateful that Ali is here with us today to help us think through them and talk with us about what comes next. Ali Abu Nima is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. I encourage you to check it out. It is an independent online news publication and educational resource focusing on Palestine, its people, politics, culture, and place in the world. He's also an author of, most recently, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, and also of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. So, Ali, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Leanne. It's really a pleasure. I admire the work of the People's Forum, and so I'm happy to do it.
Thank you. So let's get right into it. Can you tell us more about this recent attempt to annex more of Palestinian land? Where did this proposal come from, and what's the status of it now?
Yeah, so very, in the most simple terms, Israel is saying that it is going to declare that a large part of the occupied West Bank, This is Palestinian land that Israel has occupied since 1967. Israel is going to declare that a large part of this territory is now sovereign territory of the state of Israel, which means that Israeli laws apply. What it would mean for Palestinians living in that land is they would be even more deprived of their rights, because this would be allegedly Israeli sovereign territory, but they would not be given citizenship. So they would become foreigners living on their own land, which is now part of another sovereign state. So that's why a lot of people have been making a lot of noise about annexation, which is also a, one of the biggest violations of international law. International law has a lot of imperfections and flaws, but one of the key principles that has developed, particularly in the last century, is the idea that countries cannot just invade another country's territory and annex that territory, say this is now part of our territory, which countries used to do all the time. That's how the United States exists. That's how Canada exists. That's how a whole lot of other countries exist. But as a result of the atrocious European wars of the 19th century and the 20th century, the principle became established that the acquisition of territory by war is no longer admissible. And so annexation is a blatant violation of that. Having said that, in a way, the great fuss over annexation is somewhat unwarranted, in the sense that, you could shrug your shoulders and say, well, what's new? Since the very beginning, Israel has been annexing Palestinian land, and the so-called international community has been acquiescing to it or doing nothing to hold Israel accountable. And then the other issue is, what changes for Palestinians on the ground? They're already under Israeli military rule and military occupation. They're already not free. They already live under an Israeli, effectively, dictatorship. If you're Palestinian, it's a dictatorship. If you're Jewish in Israel, it's some kind of democracy. But for Palestinians, it's a dictatorship. That doesn't change. But I think the big crisis that annexation causes for a lot in the so-called international community is that it pulls away the rug, it pulls away the fig leaf, that the current situation is temporary, that eventually Israel is going to withdraw from these territories, and eventually there's going to be a two-state solution and peace. This is Israel basically saying, no, we're never going to leave, we're conquering it all forever, and the Palestinians can go to hell.
Yes. What's happened to the proposal? Where is it going to be fulfilled?
Well, that's the question. What, there was a lot of, here's what happened. Israel in its own domestic politics has gone through three elections in the past year or so. There's a big political stalemate there. There's now talk that Israel may go into a fourth election sometime this year. But as part of the deal that created the current coalition government in Israel, the deal was that Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, could begin moves towards annexation as of July 1st. Now, I think this was misunderstood by a lot of people as meaning that, on July 1st, Israel would declare that this territory was annexed. And that was never the case. It was always that this would be the start date in which Israel could begin to take legislative measures, or whatever measures as part of its internal process, towards annexation. So there's no deadline. As I say, more important than sort of what Israel is doing sort of in the legal realm in terms of declaring this territory to be part of its sovereign territory is what's happening on the ground. And there, the annexation continues. And what do I mean by that? the theft of Palestinian land, the demolition of Palestinian homes, the destruction of Palestinian farmland and olive trees and water and natural resources for the creation of Jewish-only settler colonies on that Palestinian land. That is a continuous process that was going on long before Israel was talking about annexation and is continuing right now. So Israel is preparing the ground for annexation, literally clearing the ground. Now, the annexation plans that were announced initially or floated initially was that Israel would annex the Jordan Valley. The Jordan Valley is about 30% of the West Bank that runs along the border with Jordan. The Jordan River runs through it, so I mean that's where it gets its name. It is a very fertile area. There are the major Palestinian city in the Jordan Valley is Jericho, but there's also a lot of Palestinian communities there. The thing to know about the Jordan Valley is that for decades already, Israel has been forcing Palestinian farmers off their land in the Jordan Valley. And one of the ways Israel does this is by depriving them of water. Obviously, without water, you can't grow. So you can't grow anything. You can't survive on the land. And one of the ways Israel does this is by prohibiting, again, remember, this is military rule. Now, we're talking about, you know, we're seeing all the outrage about how federal agents are behaving in Portland, where they grab people off the streets into unmarked vans. And that's normal life for Palestinians. You know, that's what military rule is. But you have to imagine that scaled up and over decades. That's what Palestinians live under. So under Israeli military rule, a Palestinian cannot dig a well on their own land. Under Israeli military rule, Palestinians cannot collect rainwater on their own land. Israel claims that the rain belongs to it. The rain that falls on the land of Palestinian farmers is not theirs. So when Palestinians collect build cisterns and systems to collect rainwater, the Israeli army will often come and destroy them. And this is part of the way that Israel makes Palestinian life unsustainable and unbearable. And that's been an ongoing process to prepare the way for the annexation so that Israel hopes that by the time it declares this land annexed, all the Palestinians are already gone.
And speaking of how Israel has been preparing the land for this, can you talk a little bit about the role of the Palestinian Authority and its jurisdiction over some of these areas? I mean, this is known as Area C, most of the proposed annexation territory, correct? And there's already been some the Israeli state has already some legal jurisdiction over these areas. And of course, like you're saying, it's military rule.
Right.
Not necessarily any agreements that anyone has agreed to, but maybe if you could help us understand the Palestinian Authority's ability to actually control this territory, some of the differences in these different areas of territory.
Right. Okay, so let me go back very briefly. Historic Palestine was one country until 1948. And this country, you know, which exists between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, was inhabited by Palestinians, Palestinian Christians, Palestinian Muslims, and a small Palestinian Jewish community. The Zionist movement in the 19th century began to settle the land. This was a European settler colonial Jewish movement, began to settle in Palestine in the late 19th century. With the support of British and other European Christian Zionist imperialists. And by Christian Zionism, that's another topic we could get into, but basically the British imperial rulers who supported the Zionist movement were themselves anti-Semites. They were interested in Zionism because it was a way to get rid of Jews from Europe, send them off to Palestine. And it was also useful to them because they saw the Zionist movement as a useful tool against communism. They saw Zionism as an ally against communism. Now, I give that context because it's important to think of Palestine as one country historically, and this land is one land. Of course, it's connected to, you know, it wasn't just by itself. Palestine was connected through trade, through culture, through human interaction to all the surrounding countries, to Egypt, to what is now Lebanon, to what is now Syria. You could take a train from Alexandria in Egypt all the way up to Beirut or Damascus. But when in 1948, when Israel was created through ethnic cleansing and military conquest, Israel was created on 78%, so basically four-fifths of historic Palestine. And the remaining 22%, what we now know as the West Bank and Gaza Strip, was not in Israeli hands in 1948. In 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So by 1967, Israel occupied the whole of historic Palestine. Now, after 1967, the idea developed, well, we'll have a two-state solution. The Palestinians will give up the 80% of Palestine that Israel conquered in 1948, and Israel will allow them to have a state in the remaining 20%, which is the West Bank and Gaza. I'm giving this context because, you know, we often talk about the West Bank and Gaza, some people do, as if that's the whole story, forgetting the 80% of Palestine that was conquered in 1948. But in 1993, the Palestine Liberation Organization agreed to this in a formal agreement with Israel that they would enter into a peace process, negotiations, that at the end of 5 years, the Palestinians hoped would result in a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. And in the interim, there would be a temporary arrangement where there would be a Palestinian authority and there would be these sort of complicated interim arrangements. And what they did was they divided the West Bank into areas A, B, and C. Area A was sort of the city centers where much of the Palestinian population is concentrated, just like in any country, you know, cities are where most of the people are. And then Area B, which was towns and villages. In Area A, you had the Palestinian Authority supposedly under full control. Area B, you had what's called Palestinian civil control and Israeli security control. And Area C, which was 60% of the West Bank, you had full Israeli military control. So Area C is the majority of the West Bank, and that's the area Israel is targeting for annexation. And what Israel has done since the Oslo Accords is accelerate settler colonization in Area C, accelerate home demolitions of Palestinian homes in Area C, and prevent Palestinians from really being able to stay on their land in Area C. So that's where you see Israel demolishing, for example, the European Union gives funds to build schools in villages in Area C. Israel will come and demolish them. Then, of course, the European Union does nothing about it. You know, they're too cowardly to respond to Israel. They just like say, please, sir, give me another. But this is where we see. And the reason Israel is demolishing schools and destroying rainwater collection systems and destroying olive trees on Area C is not, of course, it is cruelty, but there's a method to it. The method is to try to clear Area C of Palestinians, to restrict Palestinians to these ghettos of Area B and Area A, so that ultimately Israel can annex Area C. And when you look at the so-called Trump peace plan, That's exactly what it is. It's that Israel will annex much of Area C, and then there will be a so-called Palestinian state in the little areas, Area A and B, that are just sort of like split up. And it's very much like a map. If you look at a map of the United States of Indian reservations, or if you look at a map of apartheid South Africa of the so-called Bantustans, the Israeli plan for Palestinians is not some unique thing. It's exactly what the United States government did to Native Americans. It's exactly what the Canadian government did to indigenous people. It's exactly what every settler colonial state has done. The only difference is that this is happening in the 21st century.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about this, as it's known, the deal of the century, the peace plan, quote-unquote peace plan, that has come out of the Trump administration. Can you give us some more background on what the plan is proposing? It has an economic, a whole economic proposal as well. And what has the reaction been, both from Palestinians and also from the region?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, back a few months ago, now I can't remember dates. It's like we live in an endless time now of like, you know, the perpetual now that, so, you know, the first element of the plan, I think it was released in May or so 2019, the so-called economic portion. And then they followed up this year, earlier this year, seems like 10 years ago now, with the political portion. And the key thing to understand is, you know, there was a lot of outrage expressed about the Trump plan, saying, you know, this is an outrage and Palestinians would just be given these tiny little ghettos and it wouldn't be a real state and they would have to give up all their rights, including the right of refugees to return to their homes and so on. And that is all true. That's all an accurate description of the plan. I think the mistake a lot of people make, or what they don't know, is that that was the plan all along. I mean, that was always what Israel's vision of peace looked like. And this is really an Israeli plan. It's just laundered as a U.S. plan. That was always the intention. And that goes back to the 1970s. Remember, the West Bank and Gaza were occupied in 1967. And I believe 1975 or 1976, an Israeli general called Yigal Alon came up with a plan called the Alon Plan, where he said, where he sort of laid out what the future would be. And it looks exactly like the Trump plan. So almost 45, 50 years later, we're talking about the same thing. That was always the plan. The Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, who signed the Oslo Agreement with the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1993, said, "It was never my intention that this will lead to a Palestinian state. You know, the maximum the Palestinians can hope for is some kind of autonomy and little territory." So the important thing to understand about the Trump plan is its continuity. It is not somehow, you know, another outrageous thing Donald Trump has done. It is simply a statement of what the plan always was. But there is a difference. The difference is that all the previous presidents who supported these kind of plans, and I include in that Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and on, the plan was always to get the Palestinians to sign on the dotted line and to market this as an agreement between equals. Like, it's legitimate because the Palestinians agreed to it. It's a deal, right? If you make a deal with someone and both sides agree, then, you know, who can complain, right? The Palestinians agreed to it. At this point, the Israelis have realized, and the Americans have realized, that they cannot get any Palestinian to sign on the dotted line for such a plan. And that even includes the Palestinian Authority, which since its creation has served as an auxiliary force, as a subcontractor for the Israeli occupation. The Palestinian Authority, which has guns, not to fight Israel, but to fight Palestinians. That's why Israel and the United States allow the Palestinian Authority to have guns, to police their own people on behalf of Israel. Even the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas is, even if they're willing to sign, are unable to sign, because it would be the end of them. No Palestinian would accept this. So the Trump plan now, you know, is simply we impose it on the Palestinians through annexation, through force, through, you know, just U.S. The U.S. recognizes that this land is now part of Israel. So that's the only difference, that the Israelis no longer pretend that they're interested in having a Palestinian peace partner to sign an agreement with them. And so it's an exercise of force and violence in the purest form, backed by the United States. The reaction, you asked about the reaction, well, among Palestinians, of course, among the general Palestinian population, is outrage and insistence that Palestinians will continue to uphold their rights and resist. And that position really unifies Palestinians. Among a lot of other countries, it's been verbal condemnation, but no action. You know, these same countries, particularly the Europeans, they say, well, we don't support this and we uphold international law that's against annexation and so on. But they continue to trade weapons with Israel. They continue to invest in Israel. They continue to profit from Israel. And so they're not doing anything. And then we also see some Arab regimes, particularly clients of the United States in the Gulf, who are, you know, on paper against it, but who are going, you know, also warming up their ties with Israel because they think that's the way into the heart of Washington. You know, the more friendly you are with Israel, the more the United States will back you. So really what it requires is really a people's resistance. And that includes especially boycott, divestment, and sanctions. If Israel is an apartheid state, if it's a military occupier, if it is an oppressor, which it is all of those things, then it has to be resisted through popular resistance, both in terms of Palestinian popular resistance on the ground, which is ongoing, particularly the high price that is paid by Palestinians who are in Israel's prisons, 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners in Israel's jails because they refuse to accept this oppression, and in the form of international solidarity, like the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. That's the way we can start to, I think, change the balance of forces somewhat.
I'd like to get in a little bit more on this imperial partnership between the U.S. and Israel. And then, of course, it's beyond just the U.S. and Israel, but the U.S. is the main, at this moment, is the main ally. That wasn't always true. How should we understand this partnership? I mean, there's a lot of shared interests, of course, for these two imperial states. There's a lot of warmongering from both Israel and the U.S. against Iran. And Israel has also been intervening militarily in the Middle East and North African region. So can you help us understand better this relationship and how we should understand it?
Yeah. U.S. imperialism is key to this. I mean, it's important to understand that Israel wouldn't exist and wouldn't continue without imperial support. It has always relied on imperial support. The Zionist movement, which was by its own description a colonial movement. I mean, they used, you know, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, colonization wasn't a dirty word in Europe. It was, you know, when you said we're colonizing this land, it meant the same today as, you know, we're doing humanitarian work in these countries. And of course, humanitarianism is now the veil or the cover for so many wars. You know, many wars are fought in the name of humanitarianism. In those days, they were fought in the name of colonization. So this colonial movement always relied on imperial sponsorship. And first, of course, in the earliest phase, in the earlier phase in the establishment of Israel, the British. And then after World War II, with the decline of Britain, Israel switched imperial sponsors. I mean, there was a gap in between Britain. There was a brief period where it was sort of looking around for a sponsor, but, you know, very quickly became clear that it had to be the United States. And so it's very difficult to imagine that there can be justice and peace and liberation in Palestine as long as the U.S. remains an imperial power in the region. And what we're seeing in the region broadly now is, a battle between the pro-imperial forces, pro-American forces, and the forces that oppose U.S. imperialism in the region. That's where states are lined up. So the U.S. support for Israel, really Israel's persistence depends on U.S. support, but also it depends on having undemocratic client states in the region. Because if you look at the regimes in the region that support Israel and are allied with Israel, whether it's Egypt, the Gulf states, Jordan or others, these are all client states of the United States, and the only reason they're able to have either peace treaties with Israel or clandestine or informal close ties with Israel is by defying the will of their people, because these states, you know, people in the region overwhelmingly support Palestinian liberation, oppose U.S. presence in the region. So it's only by defying and suppressing the will of your people that you can maintain that kind of relationship with the United States and Israel. So I think that the struggle for justice and liberation in Palestine has to be seen in the context and part of a broader anti-imperial struggle. And Israel, of course, is an imperial client of the United States. It has always done dirty work for the United States, going back many, many years, but some notable examples in the 1980s, when Congress used to actually impose limits on what the administration could do. That, of course, is unimaginable now. But in the 1980s, Congress would put limits, for example, on the U.S. aiding right-wing regimes in Central America. So what the United States would do is say to Israel, well, Congress is preventing us from aiding these death squads. Will you do it for us? So Israel trained death squads which committed genocide, trained and armed death squads which committed genocide in Guatemala and El Salvador and other countries in South America. There were similar relationships between Israel and Southern Africa. We saw in the early 1980s, Israel became the main arms supplier to the apartheid regime in South Africa. And there are other examples, but basically Israel was sort of a useful tool for U.S. imperialism. And Israel's great fear is always to become superfluous to U.S. imperialism. And so we saw a huge effort after 9/11 by Israel to reinvent itself as sort of the frontier of the Western world. So we increasingly saw this war of civilizations language in Israeli propaganda and in American and European propaganda on behalf of Israel, that Israel is defending the eastern flank of the Western world from, you know, Islamic barbarism and terrorism. And that is another justification to support Israel and give Israel huge amounts of money and so on. One that, of course, Barack Obama very much bought into, because one of his proudest achievements that he still brags about and Biden brags about is that just before they left office, they gave Israel a $38 billion 10-year military aid package, which is the largest military aid package to any country in history. So Israel inextricably tied to U.S. imperialism. You have to fight, you have to struggle against U.S. imperialism in order to, of course, in its own right, but we cannot untie Palestine's struggle from that.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the ideological propaganda that the Israeli state and that the U.S., of course, has been putting out. I mean, you've mentioned geopolitically Israel has invented itself as this kind of this bastion of Western civilization in a place of interminable conflict and terrorism. We also have this propaganda of that the IDF, for example, is the most feminist, the most progressive army in the world, the most progressive military in the world, which is quite intense ideological manipulation. And you've also mentioned before how this is a moment, the annexation plan, this is a moment where the fig leaf has come up. Israel has showed its true intentions. So are we in a moment when there's stronger ideological cracks? Are we in a moment when people are not so fooled by the imperialist propaganda? Or is that not true? Maybe if you could share some of your thoughts on this.
Yeah, that's such a good question because, of course, you know, Israeli propaganda is always tailored to the moment. And not just Israeli propaganda, but again, the propaganda of the U.S. Politicians and institutions that support Israel. So, you know, during the Cold War, there was a Cold War justification for support for Israel. After the Cold War, you know, Israel was worried about losing its status, and then 9/11 kind of provided that that new impetus, as which I mentioned before. But Israel and its lobby have noticed a problem, which is that support for Israel in the United States, which is, you know, was not always there. I mean, there's been good scholarship on how that support really only started to escalate after the 1967 war. But it used to be in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, bipartisan, where it was across the board. And during the 60s, you had a lot of sort of liberal and leftish Western politicians who would go to Israel and extol it as this sort of social democratic haven. They would go to kibbutzes. Lots of European politicians went. And that was part of the marketing that Israel is this egalitarian social democracy. Of course, they ignored the fact that these kibbutzes were often built on ethnically cleansed Palestinian villages, even named after them. They just gave them sort of fake Hebrew names that were actually just based on the name of the original Palestinian village. But in the, you know, after 2001, 9/11, Israel adopted more and more this war on terror rhetoric, this anti-Muslim rhetoric, and aligning itself more and more with the right. And so Israel became, and particularly during the Obama administration, Israel became much more of a polarizing issue politically. Israel and its lobby played a major role in trying to fight to prevent Obama's Iran nuclear deal, which, although I have criticisms of it, is really the only sort of modestly positive achievement I can think of from Obama's 8 years in office. But Israel was very much against it. They wanted war. They wanted confrontation. But that antagonized a lot of Democrats. And so there's been more willingness to criticize Israel from the Democratic Party. And so there's a number of studies that were done by Israel lobby groups, by research groups tied to Israel in the mid-2010s, or around 2010, which found that Israel was really hemorrhaging support from the left and even from liberals, and was starting to be seen as more and more a right-wing cause. So the Israeli strategists thought about how can we win back progressive and liberal support? And they said, well, we have to market Israel to progressives and liberals. And so they came up with strategies that we call, they don't call them that, but you know, I call them this, pinkwashing and greenwashing, the key strategies, which is where you exactly what you talked about, where, you know, the Israeli army may be murdering Palestinian children, it may be destroying people's homes, it may be shooting dead Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, but it's very feminist and it's vegan. You know, that's like they will do propaganda about how Israeli soldiers have the choice of vegan boots that have no leather or animal products in them, and they can have a vegan diet, of pinkwashing, of falsely projecting Israel as this LGBTQ haven, while Palestinians are supposedly these barbaric savages throwing gay people off roofs. This is all dishonest propaganda, but it became a key part of Israel's propaganda strategy. Similarly, greenwashing, and tech washing, which you know, involves falsely portraying Israel as you know, an innovator of environmental technologies, of water management. You know, Israel sent delegations to California and to places to say, you know, we know how to manage water in green ways, which of course is a massive lie. In my book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, from Haymarket Books, which is behind me there, I have a whole chapter on the lie that is Israeli greenwashing. Not only is Israel not a good environmental steward, but it's a particularly bad one. It's actually very destructive of Palestine's natural resources and the environment. One of the things it does in the settlements, you know, they will move. For example, there are several examples of chemical factories which were in Israel and which environmental regulations did not allow to operate there, or would have forced them to spend a lot of money to make them environmentally friendly. So what did they do? They moved them to the West Bank, to settlements in the West Bank, where the pollution only affects Palestinians. So that's been one of the key propaganda strategies. The evidence is it's not working, because we're seeing now more willingness among people in the United States, particularly on the left, to criticize Israel, to support boycott, even now to start questioning military aid to Israel. And this is very much true in the base of the Democratic Party. It's not true with the elites. It's not true with, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden and Barack Obama, but it is certainly true at the grassroots, and that is filtering up. And we've seen, you know, several members of Congress elected or state lawmakers elected who've been willing. You know, I might think they're not going far enough, but they are willing to state positions on Palestinian rights or criticism of Israel that would have been unthinkable for a politician seeking those kinds of offices even 10 years ago. So that change is not, you know, is important, but it's not to give them credit. It's not to say these are great and courageous people. We should take the credit as a movement for pushing, you know, for pushing to the point where these kinds of changes are starting to be apparent in the political discourse.
You have been listening to Palestinian activist Ali Abu Nima speaking at the New York Forum on the deal of the century and the ongoing imperialist attacks on Palestine. You've only heard half of his presentation, and next week on This Week in Palestine, we will bring you the second half. So please join us then. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You can stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. and visit our archive at truthandjusticeradio.org. Click on This Week in Palestine Archive. Thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم